Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Today, we have Brett Weinstein on the podcast. Brett has spent 2 decades advancing the field of evolutionary biology, earning his PhD at the University of Michigan before teaching at the Evergreen State College for 14 years. He's developed a new Darwinian framework based on design trade-offs and made important discoveries regarding the evolution of cancer, senescence, and the adaptive significance of moral self-sacrifice. He is currently working to uncover the evolutionary meaning of large-scale patterns in human history and seeking a game-theoretically stable path forward for humanity. With his wife, Heather Hying, he is co-writing A Hunter-Gatherer's Guide to the 21st Century and is the host of Brett Weinstein's Dark Horse Podcast. Brett, great to chat with you today.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start here because you're a theoretical evolutionary biologist, and a lot of people might not know what that is exactly. A lot of people have heard of a theoretical physicist, perhaps more so than a theoretical biologist. And I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about what that means.
Sure. Well, if you think about it, you have the non-living world and you have the living world. And most of what we care about is either in the living world or a consequence of it. So it would be good to figure out what it is that evolution is trying to accomplish, if I can use a term like that, and what implications that has for the structures and patterns that we find there. So I look into those patterns and I try to understand how they got the way they are and what it implies about what we should expect going forward, especially as it relates to people.
Let me ask you something, because I've done some research on evolutionary psychology, and some evolutionary biologists really despise evolutionary psychology. They say they're not the real evolutionary theorists or researchers. I was wondering, do you have any criticisms of evolutionary psychology? What are your thoughts on the field?
I have one criticism of evolutionary psychology, which is that I think it has been a bit timid, and that in fact, evolutionary psychology represents the right question, but that we need to upgrade our tools in order to look deeply into that part of the evolutionary pattern. And I'm kind of waiting for the breakthrough, but it doesn't seem to come.
By tools, you mean self-report questionnaires on college sophomores, and generalizing it to all of human nature might not be the best methodology to understand human nature?
No. I mean, yes, we can critique it at that level.
Yeah.
That is one part. But I think overall, I think the problem is in that we have not properly understood what the relationship is between the content of human culture and the genes that underlie our physical structure. And until we understand the nature of that relationship, it's very hard to make any sort of deep progress on the cognitive side, because we don't know what sort of things to expect, and therefore which patterns violate those expectations, which fraction of them suggest we're on the right track.
What is your thinking on epigenetics and that emerging field?
Epigenetics is incredibly important. I don't think we have it placed correctly yet. But when I was in college, epigenetics was already a concept, but it applied to things like culture. Epigenetics literally means above the genome. And there was an understanding then that something like culture had to have a relationship to genes. As molecular epigenetics has boomed as a field, it has eclipsed our deeper understanding of what the epigenetic landscape is. And as much as it is revealing some of the most important patterns to be unearthed in biology in the last several decades, we need to put it in the proper theoretical context, which I just have seen almost no progress on so far.
That is super interesting. I wonder how there can be greater integration between kind of work you do and kind of work like behavioral geneticists are doing, for instance, within psychology, you know, have you thought about the twin methodology and how that?
Sure. And, you know, twins are great. They do reveal important patterns.
They're great people.
Yeah. Some of them are. Often the great ones come in pairs, but, but really we We have a general problem in science, which is that financial incentives inside the university system have caused us to abandon theoretical pursuits in many places, not because they don't make sense and aren't important, but because they don't pay. The grant overhead, being the financial fuel that runs a research university, causes us to default into favoring people who run big expensive experiments. And that has sidelined theory. So whereas theory and empiricism are partners, we treat them as if they're competitors, and experiment has won out. And it's really like your liver winning in a competition with your heart. You suffer as the result of it.
My gosh, I've never heard that metaphor before. But you suffered personally, right? You were at Evergreen for 14 years, and you resigned in 2017. Why did you resign?
My wife and I resigned. We really had no choice. The administration of the college, which was in charge of policing, had allowed an unsafe work environment to evolve, literal anarchy, in which I was actually being hunted by students these are students I had never met, who decided that I was a racist and therefore in need of some kind of re-education or punishment. They certainly were demanding that I be fired. And effectively, the president of the college sided with them by telling the police not to enforce the law. We had student patrols roving the campus armed with bats. We had people intimidated, battered. So it was a very dangerous situation, and it was not one in which we could continue teaching, having been demonized.
My gosh, what was that emotionally like for you and Heather?
Fascinating. You know, At the time I was actually teaching about the way civilization functions and what causes it to break down. And in fact, I think it was the day before, maybe it was 2 days before this protest of students erupted at my class. Again, students I'd never met before. I had delivered a model of witch hunting. And in part, it was on my mind because of what I was watching take place on the campus. But anyway, I had put it on the board, and my students and I were discussing its implications. And then a witch hunt broke out right there on our campus with me as the designated witch. And fortunately for me, I guess, the protesters, who quickly became rioters, filmed everything and they uploaded it, which allowed the world to evaluate for themselves what it was that was taking place. So, yeah, emotionally, it was absolutely otherworldly.
Yeah, that must have been quite surreal. So, despite the protesters' methods, did they have any, like, if you had a discussion with them, a cordial, rational discussion, did they have any valuable points that they were making at all?
I would love to say yes. That would be the generous thing to say. I did have many discussions with them, though. And while I found that I could frequently make progress with individuals, that the progress was very quickly erased once they returned to the collective.
To the group, yeah.
That was a very frustrating pattern to observe.
Yeah, because there's a certain amount of social status within your group, right, to amplify things.
There's that. I also think there was a great deal of fear, and that in some sense, this is the important lesson for what we're watching unfold in the wider civilization right now, is that a lot of people end up saying things that they initially don't believe because they're afraid not to. And then having said these things, they convince themselves that they're true. They basically rationalize themselves into believing these things, which on their face are obviously false.
So, Your views on this are quite nuanced, as are most of your views, if not all your views. I haven't come across anything categoric where I'm like, no nuance there, Brett, zero. But this particular topic, I've tried to look through some of your writings on, and I just want to quote you because I think sometimes you can probably be misrepresented in your views on this. So you said, to be perfectly clear, we in the U.S. have a race problem, and there is no stable solution to be built on a slanted foundation. On those two points, we should all be able to agree. So just that part, I just want to capture that part because I think it's really a great launching pad for this discussion about acknowledging that we, you know, multiple parties can acknowledge there is a race problem, but disagree on this, the solution, right? And disagree on the methods used.
Right. So the question is what? What is the race problem?
Yeah, well, I guess my question is, as you see it, what do you see as some of the major sources of the racial tensions in the country right now that we're seeing in the U.S.?
Well, to paint with a somewhat broad brush, I would say there are two populations in the U.S. for whom the goal of equality has never been attained, and that these two populations, these are American blacks and American Indians, equality has never been attained because the origin stories for these populations are unlike the other immigrants that have arrived here. So obviously the Indians arrived when there were no other people, or their ancestors did. And when Europeans arrived, they systematically disrupted the culture and maybe more importantly, the relationship to the ancestral lands that had existed. And that disruption has never been undone. In the case of blacks, most blacks who are here now derive from a slave population in which culture was systematically disrupted in order to make African-derived people compliant. And the problem is, until you actually level the playing field, you don't find out what would unfold in a fair society. What you get is patterns that never equalize, and the white population ends up suspecting it has something to do with endogenous factors in these other populations, when really it has to do with disruption of the natural relationship to habitat and to other people that exists in every human population.
Okay. So you wrote, discovering the truth about our race problem is a delicate process made impossible by de-individuation on the left and a failure of interracial compassion on the right. I thought that was really interesting. I wanted to zoom in on what that means, de-individuation on the left. I can understand the failure of interracial compassion on the right, but you've critiqued the left as someone who is on the left, right? You're still in the, are you still on the left? What's the breaking news on that?
Let's put it this way. If I take the political compass test, which is not perfect, but nonetheless,
I took that test.
I come out extremely far left. Now, that does not mean that I believe many of the things that those who are self-declared leftists believe. I actually find myself with very little overlap with them. But nonetheless, it means I believe we have a society that is not functioning fairly and that we have an obligation to change. Basically, the degree of danger we are putting ourselves in by remaining with the current system is so great that we have no choice, in my opinion. So yes, quite far on the left.
Okay. So what is this de-individuation that you're talking about, that you're seeing on the left? I'd like to zoom in on that. I every time I turn on Fox News, I hear the enemy is the far left woke ideology. That's the phrase that is constantly played over and over and over again when you turn on Fox News. Is this part of what you're talking about, what they're referring to as the far left woke ideology?
Well, I think there's something endogenous on the left, and it's not inherently wrong. It's part of a picture. But on the left, you have a tendency towards collectivism. That is to say, you have a focus on those failures that are the result of something systemic, and it is our collective responsibility to address them, which I agree there are many systemic problems, and it is our obligation to address them. But in order to do this, one tends to surrender their individuality towards a group that is marching towards some objective. And so, yes, we do see that in this woke ideology that is spreading so effectively at the moment.
So is it possible to care about both? Is it possible to fight for justice for your in-group? Okay, is all this possible at the same time? Fight for justice for your in-group, not hate the out-group, and treat individuals as individuals. Can I be a person who does all three of those at the same time, or do some necessarily pull away from others?
I don't know why any of us would do anything else. I think the
I didn't know where you were going with that. I was like,
no, society has an obligation to make a level playing field. It will never be perfectly fair, but the thing that I say that sometimes confuses people is that the unfairness needs to be randomly distributed with respect to things like race. To the extent that unfairness is not randomly distributed, it's not it's not bad luck. It's something else. It's a bias. So yeah, we have an obligation to fix those things. But on the flip side of that, you also have an obligation to individually take care of your responsibility. In other words, society has to ante up and provide you the opportunity to succeed. And you have to ante up and provide the ability to take advantage of those opportunities when they're delivered. It seems to me that these are two sides of the same coin. And the right sees one of them very clearly. It gets the individual responsibility part clearly, and it doesn't see the collective responsibility nearly as well. And the left is the mirror image.
So this is interesting because you've created an initiative, Unity 2020, that you think helps to correct some of that polarization or some of that. Let's just start with that word polarization. How do you think this plan, by focusing on center left and center right, reconciles some of those issues?
Well, you know, I'm damned if I do and damned if I don't, if I say center left and right. So people tend to react badly to the idea of centrists, and I totally understand why they do. The fact is, I'm not a centrist. I don't think there's anything magical about the center, other than the center is where we meet to agree on what is in our collective interest as a nation. It has to be. So as somebody on the far left, I can say I am happy to meet people on the right in the center to discuss what we must do. Now, Unity 2020 is an initiative to win back the White House on behalf of the American people. And it does attempt to neutralize the polarization that prevents us from ever attaining power. That said, it is not a policy initiative. The idea is that it is corruption in presidential politics and other national politics that prevents good policy from being made. So we now know that effectively the interests of the American people do not show up in the policies that are delivered by Congress and signed by presidents. These are special interests that have their desires manifest in legislation. And if it was the case that the people were actually being represented in government, we could do a lot. There's plenty of room for improvement that would make lives better very rapidly. So the objective of Unity 2020 is essentially to override the corruption and return the policymaking process to one that serves average people.
You are a fascinating human being for 47,000 reasons, but one reason right now why you're a fascinating person is because you're far left, but you're not woke, right? Like if I said, Brett, are you woke? You wouldn't say yes to that answer, that question, right?
That's a tougher question to answer than you think for the following reason. Now, I don't know whether I'm right about this, but my perception is that 15 years ago, 20 years ago, woke was something I would aspire to be because woke was actually an honorable phenomenon. At the time, woke was not something you would say about yourself. Woke was a designation that blacks would give to somebody who understood what the situation they faced was. So it was an honor to be called woke by somebody who had reason to understand the black experience in the U.S. deeply. Now, I would never in a million years call myself woke now because I find the view of America that is being advanced by this coalition to be absolutely frightening and totally un-American.
The view being just viewing everything through a racial lens primarily?
Right, and that in fact, not only must we view things from a racial perspective, but that is a desirable state, right? In other words, we are not even seeking a state in which the law or anything else is colorblind. We're seeking to accentuate these differences. And I find that dangerous, wrongheaded, abhorrent. And no, I would run from that designation at the moment. But it doesn't mean that I don't miss the honorable thing, you know, the original meaning of that term, like so many. You know, I would have called myself a feminist also because I thought what feminism meant was equal opportunity for men and women, which seems very reasonable to me. However, what feminism has become is something I can't sign up for. And so, you know, we're losing these terms.
But you're not a masculist. You haven't.
No, I'm a humanist. And,
right,
you know,
I know. Me too.
My relation.
Me too.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the rational thing to be.
So, as you know, I'm a fan of Unity 2020. This is how we got connected. I tweeted, "I'm in," you know, and I don't. If you look at all my history of tweets, the very few times do I say I'm in. I use that very judiciously. So I mean things that I say, or at least I try to mean them at the time. So I think that it's a very laudable goal. And this is my question, though, and from a strategy perspective, you want to include as many people as possible in this movement. You want people to see that there's a better way forward for them. Maybe if their initial gut reaction is, oh, this isn't for me. So this is my question is, how can we, so let's say we're talking to some of our listeners who do identify themselves as woke, right? And they don't like to constantly being painted with a broad brush themselves, right? Because in a lot of ways they are, when people just use that word and for a whole group of people to think a certain thing. But let's say there are people who are really part of the Black Lives Matter movement. They really think that the methods of the Black Lives Matter movement are the correct methods for progress, for racial equality. They're good faith about it. Let's say there's listeners who are good faith about it. How can we bring them into the fold?
Oh, I think this is so important.
Yay!
Because for one thing, the movement is fueled by anger at a system that has left people high and dry. And I think that energy is completely predictable. And we should just simply have expected this to occur. And that the twist is you have a movement that has co-opted that energy and is now pointing it to very bizarre objectives like destroying the nuclear family, eliminating the police and other things. This is not going to help Black people or anyone else. And so I think the key is lots of people are not paying close attention to what they are marching for. To the extent that they have the sense that things are bad and that they need to be fixed, the answer is, yep, you've got that right. But pay very close attention to what you've been signed up for, because it isn't, the contents of the box do not match the label. Mm. So if you're looking for real change, the first thing you should want to do is not eliminate the police. That's going to result in absolute madness. What you would want to do is eliminate corruption. It is the corruption that has allowed rent-seeking elites to concentrate opportunity so that it is not widely accessible. Mm. To the extent that that's a process that's getting worse, that millennials are now facing a rather dire career picture, the obvious answer is to fix the corruption so that policy can work in our favor rather than as a mechanism of parasitizing us.
You're just going to stop there? I'm like on the edge of my seat because...
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, so at some level, you know, I'm hesitant to say more because to me, you know, corruption is not a sexy issue. It's not fun to think about it, right? You can't imagine yourself marching on corruption and sticking a sword through it. But at some level, that thing is the key to every other issue.
I hear you. I mean, I have these like dreams that people are like, Scott, that's so unrealistic. But I have these dreams of like everyone fighting the common enemy, which is discrimination in all of its forms in any direction. I have this like dream. Sometimes I'll wake up 3 a.m. with this dream where like I'm at a rally and everyone who's been discriminated, somebody, people with a learning disability, like me, I was a learning disability, like everyone who can resonate with that experience comes together and rallies around a similar experience against the, like you said, corruption or maybe just, you know, discrimination in a universal value system format, as opposed to, oh, well, discrimination only works if you're part of that in group, but if you're part of that in group, then it's okay to, you know. So I hear what you're saying, and I maybe I'm just too optimistic. I think there's got to be a way of creating a world where we can rally around these similar experiences. I mean, my whole book was Transcend was about that, so I believe in it.
No, you're exactly right. And the fact is, at some level, we know we're being conned. The Hidden Tribes report, I don't know if you've read it.
I read it, but
It says that there's something like 86% of us who basically agree on the way things should be.
Yeah.
86%. How is it that a democracy fails to listen to 86% of its population that's in basic agreement about what we want, right? Yeah. That's a stunning fact. Instead of the 86% actually dictating the way things function, we find that we are divided almost exactly evenly so that every presidential election is a nail biter. Why is that? Why, if we have so much agreement, are we so thoroughly divided in a way that affects how power is allocated? And the answer is, we are all missing it. We are looking at each other with suspicion when, in fact, the actual enemy of our well-being is something we could easily overwhelm if we could overlook our differences. And it's not a remote dream. It's actually the way the country is supposed to work. So many people, I think, are beginning to realize that we are being played. We are about to be played racially in a way that we have not been played in a very long time. We are about to be returned to a state in which we view each other race first. Whereas maybe the greatest triumph that the nation has is that it has been headed away from that view of humanity and towards a unifying, galvanizing view of who we are and what we need.
Well, that was a great segue into Andrew Yang, because you literally just said humanity first. First of all, is there any chance at all Andrew Yang will be one of these candidates for Unity 2020? Is that still hopeful at all?
I think so. You know, it depends. I have talked to Andrew Yang, and I have specifically told him that this needs to be a draft in order to work, right? So the fact is, if he approached us now, I would turn him away, and I would say, we have to come back to you. The draft is the way that this functions narratively so that people understand. It's also the way that the success would have the power behind it to actually confront corruption, which obviously exists well beyond the presidency. So yeah, Andrew Yang would be a perfect center-left person for the ticket. He's by far not the only person who could do it, but yeah, I favor it. He's also demonstrated an ability to capture people's imagination. I don't think he likes campaigning, but he's proven that he's good at it. So yeah, I'm very fond of Andrew, and I think he would do a good job. But it doesn't have to be Andrew. And one of the things I'm looking forward to is a discussion of what the ideal ticket would look like.
Yeah. And do you have something in mind for the right? Was there a general that you were thinking of at some point?
Admiral William McRaven.
Admiral, there you go.
Yep.
I sound one of those like truth mind readers for a second. Well, I'm getting a general, you know, one of those I'm just forgetting the name of the person, but yeah.
Well, he's extraordinary, and I would suggest people look into him. I saw a recent lecture he gave, a post-COVID lecture at the Navy War College, where he was, or maybe it was the Navy Postgraduate School, where he was talking about strategic things. Anyway, he's a very decent, clearly patriotic, highly capable person who understands what leadership is and is perfectly comfortable talking about it. He's also been the chancellor of the University of Texas. He's right of center. He's anti-Trump. So anyway, he's a very interesting character, and I would suggest people check into some of the speeches he's given. I think they will find him very compelling, as I do.
Okay, that's also a good segue into my question, because we talked about how to get people, the woke far left, into the fold. What about Trump supporters? What would you say to Trump supporters? Because that's equally important. We want to get everyone in, right? We want it to be inclusive.
let's be clear about this.
Okay.
I think there are people among the woke who are so driven by this need to divide and punish that they will not join us. And there are people who are so dyed-in-the-wool, Trump or bust, that they won't join us either. But it's not the majority of Trump supporters. Mm. So one of the very fascinating things that has happened to Heather and me over the last few years is that although we are very solidly on the left, we have been embraced by a good number of people on the right, which means that we travel in those circles frequently. We have lots of those conversations. We have good friends in that group of people
now. How dare you?
Well, that's the thing is...
I was joking, by the way.
Of course you were. Yeah, yeah. But the picture, the portrait that is painted of people on the right is so in error in so many cases. And, you know, it may be that the portrait matches people on the far right fringe, just as the portrayal of these, you know, wild-eyed, insane wokists might be true of those on the far fringe, but it's not true of the average person in the street. Average person in the street is angry. They know that we have a race problem. They want it addressed, and they're not paying attention to the details. The average person on the right, they voted for Trump, but they did so as a middle finger to a system that they knew was broken. And in fact, one of the amazing facts of the 2016 election is how many people actually moved from Bernie to Trump. That's not a logical jump at an ideological level, but it is a logical jump if what you were voting for Bernie for was because he was actually a challenge to the broken, corrupt system. And so at the point the Democrats successfully dealt with Bernie, the other challenge to the broken, corrupt system was Trump. So people jumped there, not because they were pro-Trump, but because they were voting against the duopoly.
Well, this is super interesting for lots of reasons. And here's one link I thought on the spot I think would be interesting to discuss. Let me know if this makes sense. But you've done some really interesting work on the evolution of religion. And you had a really interesting discussion with Dawkins about is it an adaptation or is it a virus of the mind? Right now, I'm very interested in this topic as well. And I used to teach about this at NYU. I taught a course in cognitive psychology, and I would have my students debate those two positions for and against. What similarities are you seeing between the work you've done on the evolution of religion and some people are calling wokeness a religion these days? Some people are saying it has a lot of the similar characteristics of a religion. And I was wondering if you've made a direct sort of linkage between those two, between your earlier research program and some of these ideas you're talking about now.
Yeah. I mean, I think the analogy is unmistakable. There's definitely a lot about this movement that functions religiously, but it's not alone in that. Many things do. And in fact, the mirror image over on the, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Trump side also functions in a kind of a religious way. And in fact, sometimes explicitly so. Like, as much as this sounds like something that had to be a parody, I recently ran across a Twitter account that was in earnest, had a portrait for its banner of Trump at, you know, in the Oval Office signing a document, and Jesus was reaching down and literally guiding his hand. And it was
Holy
like
phase mirror.
But, you know, so anyway, I guess my point would be the religious modality is one that exists in human beings for clear evolutionary reasons, Dawkins' doubt of that position notwithstanding. But the nature of the particular program that inhabits that religious module is highly variable. And sometimes it's a cult, which is to say a religion that has not stood the test of time. So we don't know whether it contains information that leads people to evolutionarily sound behavior or not. Sometimes it clearly doesn't. But the BLM protest movement spreads in the same way that religious dogma spreads, which is part of what's frightening about it, because it also, similar to a religion, opts out of the mechanisms that would allow you to test the claims that are central to it.
Yes, I hear what you're saying, and I want to clarify something. I actually try my best in the psychology podcast to represent the person's views as accurately as possible, and when I don't even feel like they're representing it, I want to even represent it better than they're representing it. So I'm going to do that right now. I saw a tweet you wrote at one point where you said, I believe Black Lives Matter, but I'm not into hashtag Black Lives Matter. I think that's an important nuance to interject into this conversation. You know, some people might be listening to this and say, oh, did he just say Black Lives don't matter? Is that what he just said? And I want to be clear. You've tried to parse out these things, right? So can you elaborate, riff on that a bit?
Oh, absolutely. And thanks for introducing it. Yes, this is exactly how I feel, right? If you allowed a natural discussion of this question, I would tell you Black people, this is one of two populations in the U.S. that has had a persistently raw deal, right? Lots of other people, including Jewish people, a population I come from, and
we haven't had it too good. We haven't had it too good.
We've had trouble. We've done okay. I'm not complaining, but the point is, has there been discrimination? Of course, there always is. For Blacks and for Indians, there has been a different problem. It comes from the origin story issue. It is urgent that we fix those problems. One of the things that bothers me most about Trump's approach and his tendency to divide us is that make America great again, the again is a problem because it has never been great for some populations. And the point is to say make it great again is to suggest that we should return to some state in which it was wonderful. And my feeling is until everybody is included, we're not done. There's nowhere to go back to. So yeah, Black Lives Matter. Here's how I think the slogan means is that Black lives are undervalued in the US and that that's appalling and it has to be addressed, which I agree. It does. It has to be addressed. However, the state we should be shooting for is a colorblind state, which doesn't mean we pretend not to see race. It means that the system has to not have any biases built into it. In other words, the blindness in colorblind is the same blindness as in blind justice. You know, the sculpture with the scales and the blindfold over her eyes?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Yeah.
So we have to have a society that functions like that, that in which your race does not work for you or against you in any official context.
Kind of like a raw sort of way, like complete veil. Yeah, a veil.
I love that. The blindfold on blind justice is a Rawlsian veil of ignorance.
Yeah, I've been writing about that recently on how we should treat each other, not just morally, but in terms of ideologies and things. So what is the campaign slogan of Unity 2020? If you had insert make America human again, I'm going through a bunch of things in my head right now, but I should probably ask you what it is.
Well, you know, look, I'm hesitant about slogans because at some level we are just drenched in bullshit. And although I think there are honorable slogans, anytime somebody is involved in a branding exercise, I just want to roll my eyes.
Yeah,
but
too.
At some level, look, make America great, I'm down, right? You want to make America great, I'm first in line. Let's do that. How are we going to do it? Let's get the corruption out of the way so that we can deal with the obvious problems, right? And to the extent that there are biases and the well-being is not evenly distributed, let's deal with it at the level of opportunity. It happens that when people have opportunity, they make use of it. If they don't have the tools, let's deal with that. But these are all solvable problems if we can just get ourselves pointed in the right direction. Make America great at last, something.
Yeah.
Because
part that sucks. Yeah.
It's not even that it sucks. It doesn't accidentally suck. It's a deliberate finger in the eye to one set of people. Yeah. And it is an explicit appeal to a nostalgia that is unjustified for another. Right?
I agree. And it seems so obvious, but how come this shit isn't obvious to everyone?
Well, you know, that's a good question.
Yeah.
I would say in navigating these conversations, which is something I've been doing ever more in the last 3 years, there's often a booby trap that as you attempt to escape some path that's been established for you to traverse, you run into some obstacle and it prevents you from escaping the path. And so the trick is really figuring out, well, what do I do to get over that gap? So, you know, the one you raised is a perfect example. Are you for or against Black Lives Matter? I am for the slogan. I am against the movement. Well, what does that even mean? How could you be for the slogan and against the movement? Well, let me tell you, I think Black lives are undervalued. We have to address it, but that the movement is saying some crazy stuff that has nothing to do with that. Like the nuclear family is a white invention and it's being used. The whole idea is being used to oppress other people. That's nonsense.
Or some people have been criticizing the notion of anti-racism is actually another form of racism.
Yep. Yeah. So somehow you have to establish that I am against A without being for B. Once you do that, then you can have a discussion.
See, it's tough. I don't know if you've ever heard of the psychologist Abraham Maslow. He's a humanistic my whole project is to bring humanistic psychology back. That's like I call myself a humanistic psychologist. And he had a great concept that I'm trying to bring back called dichotomy transcendence. He really believed that wise people are those who are able to take all of these false polarized dichotomies people are talking about in society and come to a sensible integration of them, sense of wholeness. I'm trying. You're trying. I think it can be done. You see little hints of progress. You know, like sometimes some tweets do well that I write that say, look, what was one thing I said? I'm not a truth warrior, but I'm a truth explorer. You know, like I believe in social justice, but I also believe in free speech. Like some people are treating all these things as dichotomies, right? Like if you're for free speech, that means you hate black people. It's like, wait, what? Like, what are you talking about? What? No. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think when I first became aware of you, you had, I don't want to say attacked, but you had issued a kind of challenge over the intellectual dark web.
Oh, I wanted to talk about the intellectual dark web. Yeah.
Well, now's the moment. So, you know, I was somewhat troubled by your position, because my sense was that that's exactly what the intellectual dark web was doing, was it was trying to carve out a space for nuance in order to not fall into these dichotomous wells. And I guess I was troubled by the fact that you weren't for an effort like that.
Yeah, let's talk about this, because a lot of people have been saying to me, they're like, Scott, you're totally part of the intellectual dark web. And I'm like, I am? I need to ask Brett, am I? So, yeah, I want to talk to you about it because it's not part of my identity, right? It's not, you know, like this. I try to hold off on anything part of my identity. It's just like that's, but maybe that's what makes me part of the intellectual dark web, is that I like to refuse anything that that I have to like commit to a particular ideology. But also the history of that tweet, I know it really pissed off your brother, Eric. You know, he responded to me on Twitter about that. And then all of his followers, you know, came down on me, and I was thinking about it. I'm always open to revision, by the way. My head is always open to revision. I do research on the light versus dark triad. So in one way, just to give you some context, it was partly Alice Dreger and I had a wonderful conversation at the Heterodox Academy conference. And Alice had used that term, I believe, in one of her podcasts. And I was like, oh, that relates to my light triad research. I'm going to totally use that word. I didn't know what like minefield that was going to step into. I thought I was being a bit cheeky, you know, because I studied the light versus dark triad. And but okay, all that behind us, like a year later, am I part of the intellectual dark? Can you tell me what is the uniting thing about that, so I can actually think that through right now on the spot?
Well, you know, this is an interesting topic, because I don't think anybody has the answer. The fact is, there are various avenues that one explores. So a friend of mine, Ryan Bennett, wrote a piece in which he said the intellectual dark web is not a club, it's not a group of people, it's a protocol. And I actually love this. I don't think it's exactly right. I think the intellectual dark web is several different things. But protocol is certainly one of them. And the idea is, if you remind me of what Maslow's term was for avoiding these
dichotomy transcendence.
I love that. I did not know that I was reinventing a wheel.
You're going to love this stuff. Yeah, yeah.
So if your purpose is dichotomy transcendence, you are inherently interested in nuance. You are inherently interested in forging new ground. And that is certainly part of the protocol. So, you know, in Ryan's formulation, IDW is what IDW does.
In it's Ryan's? Not, did you say Ryan's?
Yeah, Ryan Bennett. So Ryan Bennett's a friend of mine.
Sorry. Yeah.
You will soon enough, I have the sense. But
Okay.
In any case, his point was, it's a protocol. It's a mechanism for interacting that avoids the usual failure modes, and it tends towards nuance because that's the way you do it. And you could also say, you know, that IDW is defined by people who register an obligation to treat points made by others that you believe to be wrong with the benefit of the doubt, so that you can investigate whether or not you may have missed something, right? So the Twitter phenomenon that we see, where people leap on somebody for saying something that they don't like, it's the opposite of that. And even when IDW doesn't work. So if you look at, for example, the initial podcasts with Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson, which fell into an unresolvable conflict over the nature of truth. It ultimately manifested in two nights of discussion over that very issue, with me serving as moderator. And I think great progress was made. I'm very proud of what we accomplished. And so the obligation to figure out what's true, or if people remember the video in which I became a public figure, where those students were challenging me in the hallway, I said I wasn't interested in debate. I was interested in dialectic, right? What does that mean? Well, it means that the purpose of argument is to figure out what's right, not to win, right? So
that's
all
what we do
things.
As college professors.
It's what we're supposed to do. It's not necessarily what people do. And so anyway, I would say, you know, IDW is no more a list of people now than it was then. And the real question is, are you behaving in this way? If so, IDW is a phenomenon and you're part of it.
So I can be IDW and have a heart, is what you're saying.
I would say you almost have to. Maybe you do have to.
That's even a requirement. Interesting.
Yeah. You know, you may not have the same heart. Frankly, I think, you know, Sam Harris is a very different creature than Jordan Peterson. They're really dissimilar. Yeah. But there's a lot of room, you know, since when is being a very different creature a bar to positive interaction? I mean, you know, I'm very different than my dog, but we really do get along, you know, and for good reason.
Is there like a formal christening process? Like, I feel like I can, my intuition is feeling like I'm on the verge of like, oh my God, I'm going to come out as IDW right now. This is going to happen for the first time in my life. Now, is there a certain formal selection process? Is there like a, you have to bow at the feet of Jordan Peterson or something? But what is the you know, is there any, can anyone be in part of this group?
I mean, I think so. I think, you know, the way you, the problem is here's what the gate looks like. The gate looks like you have to have been through something that allows people to know that you're for real. In other words, there's a lot, you could pretend that this was your ethos because, I don't know, it was a niche and you could make money doing it or something like that. Or you could behave this way because it's the right way to behave and you would do so come hell or high water. And so I guess that's the question is, do we know if you're faking or do we know if you're for real? And unfortunately, there's no, you know, it's not like there's a test. The world exposes you to the test and then we figure out whether you pass, right? Yeah, yeah. But it's not like there's a group that votes on it. It's like we get to see how you behave in a crisis and it matters.
So I'm like friends with 80% of the people who are in the IDW. But I'm still a little skeptical, and this is another question I have. Can I be in the IDW and be skeptical of the IDW? Am I allowed to? So I have one thing I wanted to point out to you, some skepticism. So you recently had on some of my favorite black thinkers of current issues going on in the world. Most of them are my friends. You know, Coleman, who I know from Columbia, you know, and we'd have coffee every now and then and lunch and have discussions at Chloe. Wonderful. But you kind of brought together this panel of people that all basically are part of the same, you know, idea framework. Why didn't you bring in that discussion, why didn't you bring in like people from the Black Lives Matter movement to debate them? Why have people who are not that far apart from each other debate each other? Is that a fair question?
I mean, it's a fair question. I don't think you're right. I think there's a tendency to see them as part of the same milieu because they get along, right? But they actually disagree tremendously, right? You have people in that group on the far left. You have people in that group pretty far right. You know, Glenn Lowry and John McWhorter, you know, they argue every week, right? There is not agreement. What there's agreement on is to be decent about it. You know, to listen carefully to what the other person's saying. You don't get to deploy talking points. And so it's funny to me that people read the Black Intellectual Roundtable as a bunch of people who agree, right? There's probably only one thing on which that group really agrees, right? And it's that we're not going to behave in a certain way, right? It's an anti-authoritarian group. Now, as for having somebody from the Black Lives Matter movement on, I would gladly do it. What my experience has been is that it is harder to get them to agree, right, to participate. So it takes more effort. The people who showed up for the Black Intellectual Roundtable on the Dark Horse podcast, I just sent them an email. They said, yep, great. And next thing you knew, we were on camera. So not against having point of view that wasn't represented in that group, but that group does not represent one point of view by any stretch.
So I take your point. I absolutely take your point. I was thinking more like if you rang Coates up, right? And you're like, will you be on this panel with these fellows? Do you think he would, well, I mean, you don't know what he would say, but.
I should say, I do think I made one mistake, which is I was trying to invite him and I was trying to find contact information. And all I found was a publicist.
Okay.
Now, probably at the point that I had the publicist's email address, I should have emailed the publicist and I would have gotten nothing back and it would have ended up the same way, but I would at least be able to say, well, he was invited too. But the reason he wasn't invited wasn't that I didn't want to invite him. It's that he was harder for me to reach. Yeah. All those other people I could reach, they were friends of mine. Some of them have stayed in my house. I know them well. In Coates' case, I don't know how to reach him. And so he was just harder to corral, and I don't know what he would have said.
Okay, so fair point. So so it sounds like the uniting thing about the intellectual dark web, you want good faithness. And
yes.
That seems to be like a core thing. If that's the case, then sign me up. You know, like if that's the case. But you're open to
it's one more thing.
Okay.
I think you have to be capable, right? You have to be committed to good faith, even when it does not function in your interest in the narrow sense. But you also have to be courageous enough to fend off what comes back when you have those other two characteristics. And so anyway, you know, it's not mine to define, but I would say if you were to try to reverse engineer what the characteristics were in people who are associated with that term, those are always present.
But the intellectual dark web doesn't function as a religion or a cult in the sense that you're allowed to criticize it from within at certain points. Is that right?
I mean, of course. And in fact, you know, Eric coined the term, but I think everybody, including Eric, is uneasy with the term. We're uneasy with, you know, are there boundaries to it? What are those boundaries? What the hell does the term mean? The term was coined ironically. So yes, every single person who's associated with it is uncomfortable with it.
Right on, right on. Thank you for all these clarifications. This is a great opportunity for those clarifications. So I want to move to a topic that is actually a mutual area of interest of ours, not as if the other stuff isn't, but this is a real mutual area of interest, is growing up with a learning disability. I have just been informed when I told people, I don't know if you saw on Twitter, I said, I'm talking, you know, to you. Does anyone have any questions? And some people said, do you see that tweet by any chance?
I did I did see it.
Because I got a million, all these people wrote lots of things. But something I didn't know is they said, you know, both you and your brother grew up with a learning disability and had some troubles in school. Is that correct?
Well, not only did we grow up with a learning disability, but we each had our own learning disabilities. So it was like we had two of them.
Can I know what they were?
Well, let's put it this way. As an evolutionary biologist, I don't really believe that dyslexia exists because I know that writing only showed up in humans 8,000 years ago. And so dyslexia is not what it is made out to be. But yeah, I to this day, I can't write something so I can, you know, if I write myself a note and I pick it up 3 days from now, there's a very good chance I won't know what it says. So, you know, severe dyslexia, if that were a real thing. But from the point of view of interfering with school, I was off track by the second grade and I really never found my way back.
Yeah. Well, you did more recently.
Only sorta.
Actually, that's true. Yeah. Only you're still an outsider in a way. Yeah.
I was an outsider the whole time.
Me
and
too.
The only reason I made it through was that, you know, I would say about one in five teachers or professors that I had decided that the fact that I was not capable of doing the normal stuff was not a reason to get rid of me because I was very good at doing some of the stuff that was more difficult. And, you know, I don't know where I would have ended up without that. Eric had a harder time. He never found an advisor, for example, in graduate school. So his story is quite different.
What was his learning disability?
It would also be dyslexia, dysgraphia, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Oh, I thought you said you both had different learning disabilities.
No, I was just saying that we each had our own learning disability. I was kidding.
Oh, okay. Got it. Okay. I didn't know if that was technically true. I grew up with central auditory processing disorder that they made me repeat third grade. Anyway, it's a very long story I'm not going to get into, but I wrote a book called Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined, which tries to talk about the science of intelligence in a way forward in an education system that appreciates neurodiversity. And I suspect this is a topic of mutual interest. Correct me if I'm wrong.
And you're
like, I don't want to talk about this. But but if you are interested in talking about this, I'd love to talk about it briefly. What are your views on IQ and some of the methods that we use to assess potential? Because I've been obsessed with this question for 20 years in my career.
Yeah, well, this is complex. It's going to be hard to know how to cover it all. But I would say, in my case, I am certain that as painful as it was dealing with what we now call a learning disability, that it was necessary to being who I became, and I wouldn't change it. If I could go back and fix my dyslexia and not have any problems in school, I would not in a million years choose that path, because being unable to deal with the structures that we are handed forces you to learn how to do things in other ways. And I'm convinced that this is among the most useful educational experiences you could have. So I think partly we have to be a bit suspicious of the way that we teach students that don't have such a disability. And we should be trying to figure out, without traumatizing them, how to provide the same kinds of hurdles so that they can learn to overcome them and become very competent as adults.
Where do you see IQ coming into the picture of that? Have you thought deeply about that measurement tool that's often used to select for gifted students?
Yeah, I think it's cruddy, but I think it captures something, and I don't think we deal with it well because there's an assumption that if it shows up in a metric like IQ, that we're necessarily talking about, some sort of genetic blueprint for the brain. And I don't think that that matches very well the emerging picture of what the brain is and how the mind develops around it. So I would say I won't be shocked if we come up with a much better measure than IQ, but IQ is clearly correlated to some things that matter. What I don't think we do very well is understand that even in the cases where we can establish that there is something genetically heritable in IQ differences, we don't understand the implications at all. And we leap to a conclusion about it, what it means, that I believe is just simply false.
Can you elaborate on that at all?
Sure. So let's say
this is important stuff. Yeah,
it's crucial, but yeah. Somehow we can't get there because as soon as you open the question, you have to deal with the danger of what it might reveal. And so there's a desire to shut down the conversation because people aren't ready to take the risk. But
we've covered this many times before on this podcast I've never gotten in trouble. So that's good news. Yeah.
Well, I guess I would have to know what it is that you've concluded, but Let's just say there is a danger of mistaking genetic heritability for an inability to alter a difference. So let me give you an example.
Sure.
Let's say that you had a bias built into a population in which some phenotypic characteristic, let's say it's nose shape, hair texture, anything that is understood to be correlated with stupidity, not because it is, but because populations demonize each other, they dehumanize each other, they do all kinds of things for evolutionary reasons. Okay, so a child who is born with this phenotypic characteristic may be understood to be stupid, not because of anything about them at the level of the nature of their brain, but as a result of a prejudice. Okay, now that child may get less enrichment in school because they're not expected to benefit from it. And when they do something well, they may get less reward because it will be assumed to have been luck, whereas if another child had done it, it would be assumed to be skill, something like that. What that means is that phenotypic characteristic will now be inherited with lower intelligence, not because the phenotypic characteristic has anything to do with intelligence, but because it projects something into the world that causes something to be reflected back that adjusts intelligence developmentally. So if you then study and you just say, well, I'm not interested in what the characteristics are. I just want to know if there are things in the genome that reliably correlate with decreased intelligence. Lo and behold, you find one. And you don't realize that what you're looking at is a phenotypic marker that causes people to interact with the person differently rather than a blueprint for a circuit in the mind, right?
Well, I agree 100%, yeah.
So what I'm saying is...
That's not controversial at all, is it?
Oh, it's not controversial, but people don't extrapolate from it. What that means is that you can identify genes that have effects on intelligence And people will assume that those genes must do have some effect on the way the brain is structured.
Directly part of the intelligence construct. I see.
Right. When the necessary mechanism may be other people's prejudice. That is completely possible. So until we do the work properly, we're not going to understand what we're looking at. And people will be leaping to the conclusion, the wrong conclusion that I think they leap to, is that brains look like bodies. We all know that there are differences in populations because we see different sports inhabited by different people. Ethiopians and Kenyans dominate marathon running, right? That's not because they, you know, have a lot of marathon running going on in Kenya and Ethiopia. It has to do with physiological differences between Kenyans and Ethiopians and the rest of us. So people assume that the mind will look like this. And there's no reason to assume that the mind looks like this. In fact, I think there's very good reason to assume it doesn't. But when we begin to see hints of something that somehow connects genetic differences with differences in performance on IQ tests and other things, people assume that's what they're seeing and they have their natural reaction. Either it confirms their prejudices or they try to drive the information out of view because they don't like where it's pointing. And neither of these things makes sense.
Well, what are the implications here for the actual behavioral genetics research? Are you saying that some of the multitude, no one disagrees in the field now that intelligence is there's an influence of many, many interacting genes. There's no like the gene for intelligence. But would you say that perhaps some of the genes which behavioral genetics put within the IQ category might actually be related to something else that causes certain people to treat that person in a way that causes their actual intelligence to increase or decrease? You're making me think of the Matthew effect with all of this as well. You know, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and there is that great research by Keith Stanovich and others showing that early readers who have a little bit of a difficulty, just a tiny bit, they don't get picked, you know, for the advanced reading team, those who do get picked, and then it continues and continues throughout the years.
Yeah, I think we don't have the first clue what we're looking at. And, you know, basically, we're a long way from understanding how the mind works. In fact, we're a long way from understanding how a C. elegans works with something like 200 neurons. So, you know, the point is, it's too early to leap to conclusions. You know, it's certainly the case that there are actual structural differences between the brains of men and women, which would be expected to have a much larger implication in terms of capacity than any difference between human races. And yet we find differences between males and females in average intelligence to be negligible. So
it's because female brains are very efficient, is what the research suggests. Yeah.
Let's put it this way. We're a long way from understanding what's going on, and it doesn't make sense to be leaping to conclusions. Now, we can talk phenomenologically about how different brains work, but in terms of being able to peer into the genes and figure out how that cascades into brains that then mature into minds, we're still in the very early stages.
I hear you, but nothing you said was controversial. I was waiting for the other shoe to drop at some point because I thought that you were saying, well, people don't take it to the ultimate conclusion, and when they do, they're going to realize just how controversial it is. But no, what you said is perfectly sensible.
Well, the problem is you have to be able to accept certain things, like
there's a genetic contribution to any of our traits, for instance.
Well, no, I don't find that one is so dangerous, but. Okay. The fact is there are differences in IQ between populations in adults. The assumption that people often make is that this is blueprinted by genes in some way. That's a faulty assumption.
Very
we don't
faulty.
Know enough yeah. to say it. And there's good reason to think it's unlikely that major differences are blueprinted this way.
That's right.
But even the acknowledgement that there are differences between populations in average IQ that are predictable is troubling. I find it troubling. Now, the question is, are those differences the result of some exposure difference, right? Differences in the quality of the environments that people are born into? Are they, you know, due to differences in the nutrition that people experience in early life? You know, there can be a lot of factors, but even just talking about the fact that those differences exist in the first place has frightening implications.
So what I find interesting about that is in certain circles, that discussion and the way it's framed is more controversial than other circles where the same exact data is discussed in a different framing. So I'll give you an example of that. I mean, I work in the field of gifted education, and I work with people who are very passionate about closing excellence gaps. And it is a fact that there are huge gaps at the very top of academic achievement. Now, when those researchers are doing, it's coming from a place of they want to make the world a better place. And that's the, like, it's obvious. That's the what they're leading from is how can we address the excellence gaps that exist. And I find it interesting because that's uncontroversial when it's discussed in that framing. But there's a different framing where someone just, if you just come out on Twitter and say, admit it, you know, African Americans are not as smart as white people. Well, of course, without context, without where is that person coming from? That doesn't sound like a very good faith person to me, you know, if they're just going to say that. So that's something that I find interesting about this topic is because, like, I am interested, personally, I'm interested in excellence gaps too in the field of gifted education. I want to understand what are the causes. I want to understand who's falling between the cracks. And to do that, you have to face the reality of the situation head on. But in that field, it's uncontroversial to face that reality head on. People are actually interested. They've gone beyond it already in my field to actually understand it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. You know, first of all, I would say the bitter pill for all of us is that we're all dummies. We could be a lot smarter if we had decent developmental environments. And the fact is we've created developmental environments that mislead us and they cause us to be bewildered more often than not as adults. And frankly, we all need to level up. So it's, you know, it's not even like trying to bring people along to, you know, the high achievers, because even the high achievers are falling far short of what they might if they had the right developmental circumstances.
That's a great point.
So anyway, yeah, of course, what we should be doing is closing the gaps and leveling all of us up and figuring out what a proper educational environment looks like. And I assure you, it does not look like a bunch of people facing the same direction with some person at the front of the room scratching, you know, hieroglyphs on the wall. This is not modern. We could do a lot better.
Absolutely. So I want to be really appreciative of your time. Do you have time for a couple tweets from others that in that thread that I put up this morning?
Sure.
That's a tentative sure because you have no idea which one I'm going to...
I don't know what's
coming. Yeah, you don't know what's coming. No, of course.
I never do.
Of course. I'll try to pick the ones that are most good faith in that spirit. Rock Whittington asked, ask him how he's doing, smiley face. How are you doing?
How am I?
Yeah, we want to know. Like, as a human, like, how are you doing?
That's a good question. And I appreciate that somebody would ask. How am I doing? You know, it's funny. 2020 is very dangerous for all of us. And I can't say that it's possible to feel good about it. There's just not a lot about it that allows that. On the other hand, it has filled me with purpose. So in some sense, except for the fact that there are not enough hours in the day, I have to say, I know what I'm supposed to be doing, and that feels good. So I think I'm all right.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Holly, 96 days until Halloween. That's Holly's entire Twitter name. I actually really like that Twitter name. Said, tips on self-improvement as an adult for people whose developmental environments were lacking or even downright destructive?
Well, I think the thing is, a lot of us have something that knocked us off track early on, and not everybody makes it back from that. But the key, I think, is if you have been knocked off track, you can't afford to have your wound remain open. You have to have it heal over and develop into scar tissue, which scar tissue is not as good as the tissue it replaces, but it does allow you to go on with your life. And so I think for those of us who have been through things that are damaging and disfiguring, getting to the point where those things are no longer the primary fact of how we interact with the world is the key. And so if you have an open wound from whatever has happened to you, your first order of business ought to be getting to safety and allowing it to scar over so you can move on with your life, hopefully enlightened by what you went through.
My sailboat metaphor, get the boat holes plugged, but eventually open the sail and move forward.
Oh, it's same
yeah.
idea.
Yeah, that's my metaphor I'm kind of pointing behind me right now. Hannah said, when was the last time he changed his mind about an opinion that he holds on something / someone?
I have one that I recall from the list.
Okay.
So many years ago, I would have been your standard advocate for gun control. And I still believe that the arguments for gun control are accurate. But I also have come to believe that although the founders did not envision the current scenario, they did leave the Second Amendment in place with its somewhat perplexing introductory phrase. Because they wanted a hedge against tyranny. And I do have the sense that that instinct of theirs is being proven right, that we are watching the collapse of structures that keep social order. And as much as that is putting us in danger, it also has left a kind of, well, let's put it this way. I wonder if the Second Amendment battle may be over as a result of the fact that individuals are recognizing that at some level they can be abandoned by government almost in an instant.
Did you see that I became a Second Amendment rights poster child overnight? Did you follow that whole fiasco?
What happened?
Oh gosh, I tweeted something. I thought you'll notice a pattern here. Sometimes I think I'm tweeting something innocuous and then I step in it, like I did with you. And here we are a year later. I'm glad you brought it up because I didn't know that it pissed you off so much. So the thing with the 2A is amendment. I was here in Santa Monica and there was a standoff between some protesters who were literally throwing smoke bombs up into our balconies. And we were getting sick. So we called the police and the police said, sir, the city's under attack. Do what you have to do. And I couldn't believe that the police just said that to me. And so I tweeted out, I can't believe the police just said this to me. And then before I know it, I have a viral tweet. You know, I have Ann Coulter. I have Ben Shapiro. I have, you know, everyone's like, this is exactly why we need the Second Amendment. So I stepped into becoming the poster boy for the Second Amendment overnight. Didn't expect that.
Yep, it's bizarre, but I mean, we're seeing all kinds of things, and you know, this is just the beginning. But it was a letter recently released by the Seattle police chief saying that they were no longer going to be able to respond to defend property. Hmm. So you know, that's a long way from not defending people. But how quickly did we get here? Is the problem?
Well, that's exactly what someone, one of the Parkland shooter survivors, tweeted out. Life comes at you fast with my tweet, and I think that was his point. Okay, PHG says why he will continue to vote left. I'm going to phrase that as a question. I'm going to rearrange that person's words. Why will you continue to vote left,
Brett? I don't know where the assumption comes from.
I know this person has a big assumption here, don't they?
Yeah, I will vote for a reason. And, you know, let's put it this way. In this election, I mean, obviously, Unity 2020 is the initiative that I'm focused on. But let's say that I wasn't. In this election, if the right offered a candidate who was patriotic and capable, I would have no choice but to vote for them over Joe Biden. Right? So the person's assumption is simply off. I will vote for a competent patriot over an incompetent or unpatriotic person every time. And it doesn't mean that I don't think we need to make progress. I'm a progressive for a reason. But at the moment, what we need is sanity. And whatever part of the spectrum it comes to us from, we have no choice but to embrace it.
I actually like that as your campaign slogan for Unity 2020, sanity, make America sane again.
I like that.
I think that's what it should be, actually. Think about it. Talk about it with your team. Dan Dolmar had a question about Unity 2020. He said, not seeing much traction for Unity 2020, is there going to be a campaign? Are your candidates going to be giving any speeches? Seems like COVID has made, quote, stumping impossible.
Well, I think COVID has made proper stumping impossible, but stay tuned. You will see things this week that will change your view of Unity 2020 and hopefully put it in front of a lot more minds.
You know what? I want to end on that note. I just think that's a beautiful note to end on. Brett, I really wish I really wish your project well. You know that I'm a supporter. I'm like, now at the end of this call, I feel like I'm 98% in the intellectual dark web. This is up from 50% before this call. So that's huge. That's huge.
Hell yeah.
And just, I really want to thank you for talking to me today, and I wish you all the best.
Well, thanks, Scott. It's been fun, and I look forward to the next one.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in on the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. If you can, please add a rating and review on iTunes. I read all of the reviews and really appreciate your feedback. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.